You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
A long slog to make international corporate tax rules fit for the digital age is nearing a breakthrough. Obstacles remain, though, but a path that gets around them is slowly emerging. In recent years, OECD member countries have been debating an ambitious plan to impose a global minimum tax rate on corporate profits for multinationals to end a race to the bottom in which countries may feel that they need to keep lowering their domestic tax rates to attract international business. Like other OECD proposals, such as the original BEPS project, measures against base erosion and profit shifting, this has so far met only lukewarm support from the US. In reality, a global solution requires US support. So the key development came late on Wednesday with a new US proposal for how taxation rights should be allocated between countries. President Joe Biden's administration wants about 100 of the world's largest companies, including tech giants like Facebook, to pay some tax based on where sales are generated rather than just where profits are declared. The Financial Times is reporting on this, and it is noteworthy in a week which saw the IMF revise growth upwards on the back of the resilience of big tech's profitability, and with SARS this week reporting better than expected tax collection numbers. Well, to review the week that was, I'm joined now by Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, and Raymond Parsons, Professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University. Warwick, the big news in our market this week was Prosus announcing the largest book build ever, just under 15 billion US dollars, 218 billion rand for a 2% stake in Tencent. But the big question is Bob van Dijk. I mean, he again has a quandary. Investors don't want him to overpay for assets, but if he's too cautious, counterbidders won't fear his cash pile. So the question is he Masayoshi's son making outsized gambles on the future like SoftBank, or is he Warren Buffett, who's built a reputation as a careful shepherd of shareholders' capital?
I think in terms of comparisons, I certainly wouldn't compare him to son of SoftBank, who has certainly never been shy of taking on debt. So that's that perhaps would be a road a bit far. In terms of the comparison to Buffett, again, he's not really in the same kind of business. I mean, when you look at startup type businesses, and it doesn't just have to be tech, but really any business that's just getting going, the financials often look quite awful. And it doesn't matter whether you in financial services, tech, some kind of manufacturing. I mean, they're all the same. It's always a case of, well, you take on a bunch of overheads and then you race like mad to get your turnover up, to get that, first of all, that gross profit positive, and then your operating profit positive, and then the bottom line positive. And really, new startups always look horrid. So it's a particular kind of skill to get those right. I mean, look, there's a lot of complaints about Naspers and the businesses they invest in. And yet, I mean, I'm sure Tencent didn't look great when they first made that $32 million investment. But they certainly look great now. Fantastic. And I'm sure it's going to be a similar story with many of the investments that that Naspers have made. I mean, I certainly can't fault them on some of the investments like Mail.ru and Flipkart and many others that have really actually been quite successful. And you're going to have duds. I mean, that's the nature of returns in any kind of equity type environment. You actually have a few winners and a lot of duds. That's the way it goes.
If you look at what the market is telling you, though, Warwick, this discount remains as large as ever. It was narrowing with some of the share buybacks, and there are similarities between the book build that we saw around 3 years ago when it sold its first tranche of Tencent to what we're seeing now. Although, if you look at what it's saying it's going to be using this cash for, the likely proceeds will be for the sale to increase flexibility to invest in growth ventures, to quote here, plus for general corporate purposes. And I suppose if you unpack that, general corporate purposes just be cash flow for now without having to raise new debt. But it's the potential of new deals now that I suppose has investors interested. The market is still telling you, though, that they're not quite buying the idea that they're going to find another Tencent.
Well, I guess that's pretty much what they're saying. And yet in looking for a direct unbundling, I mean, I don't think they're going to get one. I think there's probably an implicit understanding there that they're not going to simply dump their shareholding. And I think that's because of the kind of political environment in which Tencent operates. But by the same token, if the discount persists and management have a big cash pile, well, then share buybacks continue to build value. I mean, if you sell an underlying share and then you buy it back at half price, well, then that's actually quite a winning formula for your remaining shareholders. And at the same time, you buy out discontented ones. So from process and I suppose management point of view, they are building value for shareholders. They're just taking longer about it than a simple unbundling is all.
Yeah, I suppose that is still the dream sort of restructure, unbundling ex-Tencent assets into a new co, listing those, and I think that could unlock quite a lot of value as well. Raymond, I just want to move on to the other big talking point in the market this week was on a macro level, the IMF revising its growth forecasts and its growth outlook for the world. What are they now saying about the global economic outlook?
Hi, Michael. Well, I think it's further good news on the global front. These forecasts by the IMF are now being revised for the second time upward this year. So the IMF is looking at a 6% growth rate for the global economy as a whole, compared with 5.5% in the month of January. I think they have more confidence in their forecasts than they had a few months ago, because there are a number of positive factors working in the global economy towards that end. And in particular, I think we should note that the two biggest economies have been given very positive forecasts. For example, China, they expect will grow this year at 8.4%, and the United States at 6.4%, which ties in with what the Fed was saying a week or so ago, 6.5%. So by and large, I think it's a very positive picture for the global economy. Now, why is this happening? Well, it's partly because of the additional fiscal support which we've seen in China and the United States, the fact that there's a better vaccine rollout in several, though not all, countries, and then there's simply a cyclical rebound. Just as in South Africa, this is a rebound from last year. But what is important that you can see this reflected in the commodity markets, in the financial markets, and so forth. So from the point of view of the global economy, it can only be seen as good news. One of the interesting factors, which I think we'll probably come to, is that if you look at the forecast for what they call the emerging and the middle income countries, that is in fact 6.9%. And since we fall into that club, no doubt we'll talk a little later about what is our position in that particular scenario. But by and large, in terms of exports and expansion in the world economy, it's good news.
It's good news, all boats being lifted by this rising tide and the rebound from last year's annus horribilis thanks to COVID-19. No doubt South Africa is not amongst the leaders in this emerging market scenario of 6.9%, very much amongst the laggards. Warwick, what stands out for you at a macro level from the IMF revision upward this week?
I mean, obviously, it's positive, but it's I guess one new zig amongst a story of many moving zags. I think the key point remains that South Africa is well below any kind of global average, and it points to the structural issues in the economy that need to be fixed, and we've banged on about that to quite a substantial degree, and persistence has to be shown. They've got to get on with it. They've got to deal with the issues at Eskom. We clearly have a supply side problem in this country. We also have a capital allocation problem, and we have a capital attraction problem. Nothing's new in that, but we have to deal with these issues. And I think the IMF with this growth forecast just highlights it once again.
Yeah, well, it all starts with capital allocation. You start delivering more effective capital allocation. You start to attract capital in as you build confidence and as you deal with some of those supply-side issues like delivering power. And that's why using the private sector through PPPs and the REAP program is the way to do it, because government has been shown to be such a poor capital allocator. Raymond, if you look at the IMF numbers, it upped GDP for South Africa, its forecast from 2.8 to 3.1%. I think it's probably still on the bearish side. Very noted bearish economist Peter Attard-Montalto has it closer to 4%. What do you make of that number?
Well, I think what's important, though, just to revert quickly to the global outlook, it was also with a health warning that firstly, there's still a great deal of uncertainty in the global economy. And in fact, if one looked at the performance of certain countries, it's very uneven. But I think nonetheless, if we focus more particularly on South Africa, you will notice that the IMF forecast is still among the most conservative ones. It's 3.1. For this year, compared with the budget forecast of 3.3, the Reserve Bank 3.8, and some of the private sector economists have gone to 4 and 5. I mean, I personally think we're probably in the ballpark figure of about 4%, but I think because it's a rebound, as I've said before, I'd rather be broadly right than, in fact, precisely wrong. So I think we've got to understand that is a range within which we will see where this rebound goes. But as our Northwest University Business School Policy Uncertainty Index indicated, it has declined slightly. It's been leveling off because I think it's captured some of the better short-term news that we can take for granted this year, by and large, if we get on with our vaccination program, infrastructure, and so forth. The important point, though, for us, and this is where we differ from some of the other countries that are recovering quite quickly from the pandemic, is that if we go back a year ago and we revive our memories, we must remember that we were already in a bad space then. And all that the pandemic did was to reinforce that back. We were in a recession, whereas most other countries were in a positive cycle. So what they're doing now, provided they handle the health front properly and have supporting policies, they're finding their way back quite quickly to a positive cycle. We have to now understand that the short-term better news doesn't mean that the underlying health of your economy is necessarily fundamentally sound. That's what our index is saying. It's saying, yeah, look, there's still a deep and a wide uncertainty about the structural reforms, the other important growth plan, how we handle the vaccination issue and so forth. These are important structural issues in South Africa's case that we need to implement. We need implement-led recovery to underpin the short-term recovery, to make sure that it will be sustained in the years ahead. So we've got a double challenge here.
It seems to be the rise of the US under Joe Biden, Raymond, into a role that he's trying to take the US that it held in the past, one of global leadership. He's trying to win friends and influence people. And his Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, has got an interesting way of doing things by pushing for a global minimum tax. But last week, on the eve of the IMF World Bank spring meetings, she was calling for a move towards this global minimum corporate tax. And she also vowed to reassert America's leadership in economic policy. Firstly, what does renewed US global economic leadership mean for the world economy? Should we be fearing or favor that kind of direction right now?
Well, I think that we should on balance favor it if we compare it with some of the things that happened under the Trump administration, a positive leadership from the United States should be favored. I think what we need to understand, though, in these initial moves, that President Biden not being Trump is not enough. And in fact, some of the rhetoric may change, but some of the United States policies that have been put in place still remain. In other words, I suspect that the Biden administration will still walk softly, but they'll carry a big stick on some issues. They're not going to change. But what's important here is that you have an administration that's more committed to a rules-based system in the world and is prepared to consult on a positive basis, not on the basis of, you know, be reasonable, see it my way. I think the important point here is that you do have a constructive administration willing to engage. Now, this, I think, is important for an international organization like, for example, the World Trade Organization, which has deteriorated enormously because of the lack of support both from the United States and from China, not playing according to the rules. So I think hopefully we'll see a revival in the legitimate role of various institutions, including the IMF. It's interesting that, for example, Janet Yellen has taken her proposal about the corporate tax to the IMF meeting for an engagement. So I'm hoping on balance we will see a more constructive leadership from the United States, but in a changed world. It's no longer a unipolar world. It's a world in which there's going to have to be more engagement, and it's just as well we now have an administration in the United States that on economic and indeed other matters is prepared to engage in a more constructive way than has been the case in the past few years.
Well, one of the biggest signals for me at the end of unipolarity was the Chinese in Tehran recently and the way Iran is pivoting, which is a big threat to Saudi, which brings the US into that. And we know the US and China remain at loggerheads over so many issues. But Warwick, my question is around Biden's economics. And the leadership that they're displaying in the world at the moment, the US, seems to be taking us down a kind of anti-Washington consensus type path. Very Keynesian, big government, big spending, and let's just raise taxes to pay for it. What do you make of that?
Well, I think what's quite interesting there is how quite a lot of their policy is simply picked up from the Trump administration and run with, particularly when one looks at the punch-up with the likes of China, for example. There's hardly any change to take notice of whatsoever. So I'm finding this kind of, the more things change, the more they stay the same, rather curious. As of course, is this whole curious call by Janet Yellen for an effective universal corporate taxation rate, which I have very mixed feelings about indeed.
Let's turn to that now, Raymond. I also find myself with very mixed feelings because there's this so-called race to the bottom, this fiscal race to the bottom. But surely it's within each sovereign nation's discretion and purview. If they want to attract business for the positive net benefit of creating employment, to lower their corporate tax rate to whatever they want it. I mean, effectively, if you look at what a corporate tax rate is, we already pay income tax and then we use our after-tax income to go and buy shares in companies and then we're taxed again. I think governments get a double bite at the cherry. So if they want to go down to zero, well, why not?
Well, Michael, if I could build on what Warwick has said, I just would make the point at the outset. Why has Janet Yellen, in fact, raised this? Well, the cynic in me says, well, because they have a large deficit and they're now planning to put up corporate taxes. If they do that, it widens the gap between their corporate tax rates and the rest of the world. Yeah. So suddenly we discovered the reform, and there's been a long debate on this. This is not a new issue. It's been rediscovered, work done by the OECD, for example, over several years, because there is a problem. There is a problem with the erosion of tax bases and so forth. The question is, how do you deal with it? Because we've got a globalized, we've got a digital world, we've got a service-orientated world, etc. We've got intellectual property. All these are intangibles which are difficult to capture in a tax system. So I think the issue here is simply not that you will find a universal or a global solution, but you'll get some outcomes here, already some steps about exchanging tax information. I think one can understand that some disciplines need to be applied. But I think the issue of a universal global minimum corporate tax by June, given the variety of problems that the existing reform measures have already run into, which means you've got to be very pragmatic. And it's very interesting, I might mention, there is an index called a tax competitive index, which is published every year. And at the top of the list is Sweden, Australia, New Zealand, and Estonia for some reason or another. But anyway, we are not in that. But what I'm trying to say is, you will have to manage tax competitiveness against the concerns of the tax gatherer. And that revolves around a number of important economic global issues. Yep. There will be no easy solution, but I think some partial reforms which will at least level the playing field and diffuse the anger that there are corporates who are not stepping up to the tax plate. So I think something will come out of this, but I think we're going to be far short of this ideal of a global minimum corporate tax. I certainly think that the multinationals should engage in this debate, and if they have concerns about how we are going to reform this issue, or how the IMF and the World Bank want to reform these issues, or the OECD, they must ensure that business engages in that debate if the debate is to be taken further.
Once again, Warwick, comes back to your point about capital allocators. Who do you think are better capital allocators, governments or private enterprises? And where should we be directing society's capital? What is your concern with this call now for a global minimum tax rate?
Okay, well, in terms of who's the best capital allocator, I mean, there's no contest. I mean, private capital is far more efficient than any government, and it's for a very simple reason. It's because, first of all, it's often the entrepreneur themselves which has skin in the game, and the second point is they don't really get bailed out so often, whereas government, you can be as useless as the day is long and you will get bailed out, it would seem. So yeah, I mean, that's the first point there. As far as the US call goes, I mean, I think it's really quite disingenuous and dishonest. I mean, it's fairly typical of politicians who are looking to dodge whether or not they actually are effective and competitive, and trying to parcel it along by blaming evil, nefarious forces. The reality is that the US is extremely cheeky when it comes to its tax regime, and it's actually a very different tax regime to many other countries. I mean, one only has to look at how they tax the corporations that invest offshore. I mean, effectively, they apply a double taxation there, which is actually really quite nasty. And the other stunt they like to pull is the likes of a non-resident estate duty. So, for example, if you have a Schwab account and you keel over, Uncle Sam says, thanks very much, I'll take 40% of that. So the US, if they want to play a global game here, best they first of all put their own house in order and do some kind of their own standardizing along the lines of how the rest of the world conducts its tax affairs before they start trying to tell everyone else what the rate is going to be. Of course, tax dodging is a problem. It has to be dealt with. This is not the way to do it.
And why these proposals are very, very far from being implemented, because I have a sense that there are many out there who share your sentiment. If we look at Ireland, for example, which has been a big beneficiary of this strategy to be competitive with its corporate tax rates, that's a far deal from being done. Speaking of Ireland, Raymond, the troubles, or at least the specter of the troubles, were reignited this week with scenes of burning buses in Northern Ireland, lots of youth unionists involved, and it looks like the post-Brexit era is ushering in some painful realities over there. What do you make of it?
Well, Michael, you know, I've said more than once that when we look at the saga around Brexit, it's not called the English Channel for nothing. And that has been the symbolism of the whole debate and the whole process around Brexit and the issues of sovereignty and so forth. And the fact that it's the English Channel and not some other channel probably reinforces that particular symbolism. I think the second point to understand in this whole Brexit process is it is a process. I think we've said more than once, it's not an event. I'm reminded of a saying by some Chinese philosophers asked recently what they thought was the outcome of the French Revolution. They thought it was too easy to say. It was too early to say. So the important point, yes, there are some unintended consequences, some intended consequences, which are now beginning to materialize about a decision which, of course, the United Kingdom, it's their right to take it. But that doesn't alter the consequences. The fact that you may have good reasons for doing something, or you think you have, doesn't mean to say some of the consequences. And already you can see on the trading front some distortions, more particularly on what I'd call the non-tariff barriers. In other words, like the Irish problem, where do you draw the line in the sea? An example, how would that jeopardize the Good Friday Agreement? Because would that mean that certain tariffs would have to go up between North and indeed Southern Ireland and so forth? So these chickens are now coming home to roost, both politically and economically, and will have to be managed, because it's a given situation. There's no going back. You now have to manage those consequences and see if you can reduce the economic costs that are built into your fundamental decision, and a very thin agreement which is still being negotiated. So I think there's a lot of uncertainties, both political and economic, that will arise from the Brexit process.
But it does tie into this theme around global taxes as well. And the nationalism that we had seen prior to COVID, that's certainly coming home to roost to these pro-Protestant British nationalists, feeling that they're losing their connection to Britain in this post-Brexit era that we're living in. So very interesting. On the eve of the 23rd anniversary of that Good Friday Agreement, that was Professor Raymond Parsons of the Northwest University School of Business and Governance, and Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, with the brass tacks of this week in review.